Hey everyone, this is episode 3 of the Bad Apples, and today we're gonna look back at from whence we came. We're gonna look back at Apple. You know, I mean, I've switched to Linux and full time now Linux user, not regretting it, but sometimes you have to look at Apple and just you have to recognize what they do well, and you have to give it up for that. You have to give it up to them for what they're doing really well. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that on this episode. The first thing I think that I miss probably the most about being a part of the larger Apple family is the satisfaction of going out to the store and putting down $130 and grabbing that new operating system with over 300 new features, taking it home, putting it on your computer, and sure, it might eat one of your partitions. You know, you might have had a Linux partition on that computer, and when you put in Linux Leopard to install, even though you tell it not to touch that other partition, you know, you've partitioned it correctly, you've done everything right. Maybe it'll eat that Linux partition. Maybe it'll destroy what you had on that other half of the hard drive. Not a big deal, right? So it's really nice that once you get that all squared away, that when you boot into Leopard, it might have changed your administration password, your root password. It might have screwed up some file permissions. So you have to go in there and kind of do some file permission hacking. But I mean, what do you expect? You know, you're installing a new operating system. Things are just going to break at some point. And, you know, installing a new OS, that's as good as anything else to break something. Am I right? So that's really, really great. But what's really cool, too, is that you get that nice box with the pretty artwork on it, and you get the nice disc with very attractive artistic stylings on top of that disc. And one thing that I have taken to do, now that I do have a copy of Leopard, is I right along with those AOL discs that I get in the mail, I use them as coasters now with Leopard. That's a really great feature. You're not going to do that with a Linux disk. You know, you don't get the pretty artwork, and you're probably going to use your Linux disk, so you're not going to use it as a coaster. To be fair to Linux, you do sometimes have older Linux distributions that you no longer need as much anymore, so you could probably use those as coasters. They're just not going to look as nice. Well, unless they're a disk that you got from a magazine like Linux Format or Linux User and Developer or Linux Magazine. They oftentimes put very attractive artwork on the disks. So in those cases, you do get the nice disk, and those are good showcase pieces as well. Not as good for coasters still, because you're probably gonna actually get use out of them. Now the other thing that I really miss about, I think, the Apple family are the great, you know, 300 new features of Leopard. Because, I mean, I thought that Tiger was a pretty solid operating system, and when Leopard was coming out, I was a little bit I was wondering if it was really going to be that big of a deal, if it could actually be, you know, that much better. And, you know, it amazed me that it's packed with new features, you know, and sure, some of them have been around in Linux, you know, for a very long time. But, I mean, features like this, reopening Windows. When you close Safari, you can reopen Safari and it will recall the set of windows and tabs that you had open before. Now, Firefox has done that for quite some time, but now so does Safari. You have the Arabesque screensaver, the shell screensaver, the word of the day screensaver, the clock overlay on the screensaver, a collage screensaver, and a mosaic screensaver. That's six new features right there that, you know, I don't know if any other operating system has exactly those same features. So that's quite exciting. Also, turns out that you have, you know, spaces, and there's, you know, spaces, there's the bird's eye view spaces, there's the add and remove spaces, there's the application binding, and there's the bump to adjacent space. That's five new features right there. It's astonishing. And then there's, of course, Spotlight, you know, the ability to search on other computers with your Spotlight, you know, on a network. Wow. There's advanced searches. Pretty interesting. There's dictionary definitions in Spotlight, just like there was in Catapult for KDE and Quicksilver and things like that. There's calculations in Spotlight, again, just like in Catapult for KDE. Spotlight applications launching, just like in Catapult with KDE. There's web history search, which, of course, you can also do in Safari or Firefox. There's searching for file names and searching for system files. That's eight new features just in Spotlight. It seems almost mind-boggling that a lot of those features are new. You'd think they would have already been in there. In fact, I really thought there were. But now they're there again, for sure, this time. You know, I mean, the list just goes on and on. I mean, with over 300 new features, I don't even know really even where to begin. Let's face it, auto-saving documents in TextEdit. I mean, everyone uses TextEdit, and, you know, they've put an auto-save feature in there because they heard the demand of people needing that. What about Quick Look, the exciting development in Leopard that actually shows you not generic thumbnails, generic icons for all your pictures and things like that, but actually draws previews of those icons or the documents and makes that the icon. That's very, very exciting. You know that little photo booth application? There's six new features in photo booth. There are at least six or eight new features in iChat. Internationalization, forget about it. They've made leaps and bounds in the internationalization area of OS X. There is now Russian localization, Polish localization, Portuguese localization, enhanced internationalization font, JIS 2000 support, expanded font set in Japanese, Spotlight language support, expanded keyboard support, new input methods, Russian spell checker, and Danish spell checker. That's 11 new features just in the international category of their operating system. It's exciting stuff. And let's not forget things like Front Row, which is their media center feature that most people don't realize exists on their OS. And there are five new features there. Things like an Apple TV-style interface. And apparently Front Row itself is a new feature of OS X Leopard. Marketing has always been a strong point at Apple. And that's a really great thing because you need a strong marketing machine to peddle your wares. One of the things that they marketed very well was the iPhone. And when the iPhone was marketed, it was going to run OS X. It was going to revolutionize the iPod and the cell phone and the computer industries all at once. And it was going to be basically the best thing to ever happen to the computer world. And that was very exciting to me because OS X has a lot of, you know, everyone loves OS X, right? It's got a lot of things that people associate with OS X. It's got a desktop, it's got the Finder, it's got applications that you can add to it, things you can install, things you can save, you can copy and paste even. You know, that kind of is OS X to a lot of people. And what was really exciting was that the OS X on the iPhone was an all-new, different OS X. Apparently it's still OS X, but it's quite not what everyone thinks of OS X as being. In fact, there is really none of the functionality of OS X, the operating system, on the iPhone. About the only thing it shares anything in common with it is, I guess, Safari, which is the web browser. But that's not really part of OS X, it's a web browser. But assuming it is part of OS X, since it is on the 300 new feature list, that's the only thing similar between the OS X that we knew and the new revolutionized OS X of the iPhone. I'm so excited about the iPhone version of OS X, which, by the way, runs a modified Darwin kernel, specifically modified for the ARM processor, and we call it OS X. I'm so excited about it that I wish Apple would just release the iPhone OS for computers. And I think that would be fantastic. You could write notes to yourself. You could browse the web. You could make phone calls. You could text message. You could check stocks. You could watch YouTube. And you can check the weather. And the time. And let's face it. Do people really need to do anything else with their computers? I mean, that's a pretty robust operating system right there. What is this Leopard thing when we have iPhone OS X? Let's use the iPhone OS X to its fullest capability on our computing devices. Let's load it onto Mac Pro with 8-core Xeon processors, 12 gigs of RAM. We would be able to write more notes to ourselves faster than ever. We would be able to surf the web and go to YouTube and see the selection of YouTube videos that have been ported over to H.264, but not the ones on Flash. And it would be just exciting and wonderful computing experience. That's what we need to do. Get rid of Leopard. Get iPhone OS on all the Apple devices. That's exciting stuff. That's the kind of stuff that makes my blood start really pumping through my veins. As an iPod, the iPhone is phenomenal. Think about it. Again, there are certain things that we kind of associated with iPods before the iPhone came out. Now, iPods you would plug in, they would mount on your desktop, you could use it as a flash drive, you could also put music on to the iPod. Couldn't take it off, of course, but you could put it on and shuffle things around on the iPod and do all kinds of cool things. You could set it so that the iPod would sync to the computer, or you could do it all manually. The iPhone does away with all of those options. It really, really simplifies things. Not only can you not use it as a flash drive anymore, which was nowhere in the marketing material, so that was a nice little surprise that they gave everyone, but they also, you can't talk to it at all, except for brief, stinted conversations that you can have with iTunes to the iPhone. And there's only one option, and that is to sync, so that if your music isn't on the computer, it will then be taken off the iPhone. So you'll always have to mirror your iPhone with your computer, because otherwise it'll sync and take everything away. It's really quite exciting. I mean, the sheer simplicity of it is almost mind-boggling when you think of the potential that the iPhone has. I mean, it could be such a complex device, but they've really pared it down to just its barest simplicity. It's really exciting, innovative stuff. And don't even get me started on iTunes. Who could live without iTunes? I don't know how I'm living without iTunes now that I'm on Linux. It's probably one of the things that I miss the most. I mean, I remember back in the day, we had SoundJam and Audion. Those were media players for the Mac, and they were quite good. They would play music, and you could put your music anywhere on your computer or on a CD or on a zip disk or anything that you had, and you could play it through SoundJam without any kind of, or Audion, without any kind of backflips or copying into a central database somewhere that you maybe didn't even want to copy it to, things like that. But iTunes came and killed off both of those projects, thank goodness. iTunes has a central database that it maintains and keeps in order. If you so much as double-click on a sound effect file, just because you want to hear it, it'll open up in iTunes, and it will add itself to the master library in iTunes, whether you wanted it there or not, and it will stay there forever. Even if you delete the file off your computer, you go back to iTunes, and there it is, with a little exclamation mark, telling you that it was once played in iTunes, but now it's not where it used to be, and so it can't find it. And what's really fun, if you want to do this sometime, is move all of your music to different places on your file system, and then open up iTunes. Everything will have the exclamation mark by it. It won't be able to find any of the music, and you'll have to go through song by song, not album by album or artist by artist, but song by song, to go reconnect all that music to its master list on the library. that's a great way to spend an afternoon. That's something that everyone can kind of get into and kind of get behind. People could say, you know, hey, what are you doing tonight? And they could say, oh, I'm going to go home and fix iTunes because it lost track of all my music. And people could even have parties where they kind of get together and fix iTunes libraries kind of as a community. And that would be fun. Now, the iPod itself, of course, is a grand tradition and really helped boost iTunes up into the market. I mean, I can't imagine that iTunes would have been quite as popular if it weren't for the fact that the iPod, a very convenient little music player for many people, hadn't been so popular, mainly because you can't talk to the iPod with anything else but iTunes, so it really helped. Now, the first generation of iPod, I happen to own a first generation iPod, and it's a little bit thicker than the current ones, and it has a FireWire port on the top. So basically, you could plug it into any computer with a FireWire port. It was very flexible. Again, there's that flexibility thing. Luckily for us, Apple did away with that on the second generation and introduced to the world a new connector. A 30-pin slim little connector on the bottom of the iPod itself that went out to a standard USB cable. I was so glad to see that they didn't just put maybe a USB port or a mini USB port on the iPod, but instead that they came up with a new cable, a non-standard and proprietary cable that ensures that I'll only be able to use that cable with my iPod, because if I were to ever go out of town and forget that iPod cable, and maybe I would have another USB cable on me, that way I don't have to use that other USB cable on the iPod, because I have to go out and I could just go out and buy one of those iPod cables. And that's so much nicer, I think, than having to use the same cable for lots of different things. Because instead of just having one or two cables with me, I'll necessarily have to have that proprietary cable as well. And that's a good feeling. And it's a good feeling to know that probably I'll be able to go out and find that cable somewhere, pretty much wherever I go. So it's nice. And it's only going to be $30, maybe $20. It seems handy to me to have that kind of market backing me. And what's really exciting is that now that I've bought accessories for the iPod, like things that I can plug into my car so that it will play through my car radio, things like that, well, if I ever decide to switch devices, maybe try a different MP3 player, well, that extra hardware that I got will also be something that I'll have to throw out because it's not compatible with anything else except the iPod. It's very exciting to know that there's such a strong pairing of devices. You know, it was really great to find that even though the iPhone was going to replace, you know, be the best, most revolutionary iPod ever, that it's not compatible with that car adapter, and that in order to play the iPhone over the car radio, I'd have to get a different adapter. So that was a pleasant surprise in itself, because I really thought I was going to be stuck with that old car adapter that I had, and I was in the mood to pay another $80 for a new car adapter along with the iPhone. So it was kind of nice that they got me to do that. And I love how Apple and the programmers out there kind of have a fun little cat and mouse game going. It makes me chuckle, and I'm sure it makes them chuckle as well. You know, Apple will change the entire structure of the underlying database inside of the iPod every so often so that when programmers are releasing their software, they suddenly have to redo all their work with the new generation of iPods because everything's inexplicably changed. And it's so fun to look inside of an iPod through the terminal or something and kind of get an idea of what that database looks like. Such a wonderful maze of ambiguously named, completely irrationally organized MP3 files. It's just such a wonderful puzzle, really, is what it is. It's a game that you can play with your iPod because there's no other way to get your songs off unless you get some of this third-party application stuff. And there's going to be a delay in that because Apple keeps changing the underlying database of the iPod. So it's a lot of fun, kind of adds a new dimension to how we organize and enjoy our media. And speaking of media, isn't it great that Apple is such an innovator on file formats? I mean, think about it. We had MP3, we have AUG, and now with Apple we have AAC, .mpa, .mpv, all kinds of new interesting suffixes for your files that won't play on anything else, unless it's an Apple-branded hardware and software combination. Well, that is a fantastic idea, because really, what am I going to do with my files? I mean, I wouldn't want to play a media file on anything else but my Apple and hardware and software, right? I mean, realistically, do I need some kind of standardized file format? Probably not. I mean, if I bring some music over to a friend's house so that we can listen to it, and it doesn't play on their system, big deal, they should have a Mac anyway, right? Oh, except that all the music that you buy from the iTunes music store will only play on 5 systems, or 5 devices. So if you're someone like me with lots of computers and lots of gadgets, you can spend a lot of time kind of deauthorizing and reauthorizing different devices with every song. And if it was a song that you bought a long time ago and you've forgotten the password, that's kind of a problem because you're not going to be able to get it. But that's not really that big of a deal because you can just go to the iTunes store and buy it again, because you don't really want to deal with customer service anyway. I mean, no one likes to deal with customer service and getting usernames and passwords emailed to them and things like that. And certainly, it's just not feasible for there to be any kind of record of your purchases, since it was all done digitally, tied to your credit card number and your name and everything else about you. So obviously you couldn't just go to the iTunes music store and re-download a track that you might have lost. No, you have to rebuy them, just like a real CD store. You know, I mean, that's what Apple is trying to emulate. You know, if you lose your CD, you're not going to go back to the store and say, hey, I lost my CD, but I did buy it, so could you just give me another disc? And they give you another disc. Of course not. You're going to have to buy it again. Well, that's the same way with these digital files. You're not getting the disc, you're not getting the artwork, you're not getting any of that stuff. But if you lose it, there's no record that you ever bought it, basically, and you have to rebuy it. Now that is realism. That's taking you out of the digital world and putting you solidly back on solid, firm, terra firma. And that's a good kind of reality check that Apple is helping us out with. I like that. I can respect that. Strange file formats don't just stop with audio and video. No, no, no. Apple has been innovative yet again, and they've created wonderful new file formats and file extensions for all of their flagship products like iLife and iWork. I mean, Pages documents. Try opening that in some other application. It just won't work. And if you do crack it open with some kind of weird text editor, you're going to have to wade through all kinds of code just in any effort to find whatever bit of logical text that you were looking for. And even that you'll probably have to clean up quite a bit. Hey, standards and compatibility are really for wimps. You know, I mean, it's not something that we really need. It's not something that we want to encourage. We want to have file formats that are as closed and locked down and kind of isolated as possible, because it really shows how much confidence we have in the products from a certain company. So if we get tired of using iWork, or if we decide not to upgrade our iWork continually every release, and we decide to try to use something else, well, we'll have all those documents in the iWork format that won't be compatible with anything else but iWork. So it'll either encourage us to clean out our digital data and kind of get rid of some of that old stuff that we probably didn't need anyway, or it'll encourage us to, after all, go ahead and update our iWork so that we can access our old data. So it's kind of keeping us on our toes, which is always a good thing, let's face it. And if one of those files ever becomes corrupt, which, I mean, since it's Apple, that would never happen, but should it ever happen, it'll be a lot of fun trying to get our data out of those file formats, because they're so convoluted that simply getting in there and fishing out the data will be impossible. And that's always a good thing, because everyone loves a puzzle. But you know, these are just consumer applications, and those are so, well, they're so consumer. I mean, there's professional applications out there that Apple is pioneering the world with. They're just taking over industries with their professional applications, which, you know, you thought $130 for an operating system was great. Think about $1,400 for some professional video editing applications. Again, marketing machine is great here. The marketing pictures of all these high-end applications running on mere laptops. Wow, how exciting is that? What's really exciting is actually trying to load those applications onto a laptop and having them and trying to run them with a reasonable amount of time just to do basic functions. Well, what the ads don't tell you, and again, this is just Apple kind of playing a little gag on its consumers again, is that those applications are going to crash your system, and it will crash your system hard, or it will just drive you insane with the amount of time that you have to wait for the most basic processes to be carried out. But that's just because those professional applications are so robust that that's just par for the course. Now, granted, Apple could put in their marketing campaign showing these applications running more realistically on an 8-core Mac Pro, but that might intimidate people. But it is, I mean, these professional applications are just so big and robust that they will work really, really, really well with about a third of the possible file formats used in their respective industries. Now, sure, that leaves out two-thirds of file formats that the rest of the world is going to be using. And sure, there might be some time that you're bragging and bragging and bragging about your Mac and your Mac software and your Final Cut Pro and your Motion and your compressor, and someone brings you a file format and it happens to fall in one of those two-thirds of file formats that those programs will not understand. But, I mean, that's why people invented converters.
Yes, full-bodied, refreshing hot coffee makes any time a pleasant interlude. Won't you have some now?
Marketing Machine at Apple is also really fantastic in terms of like the really high-end stuff, like the X-Grid, which is an engine that enables you to network a whole bunch of your computers together and dedicate all that processing power to the video project you're working on. The Apple marketing material makes this sound like something completely possible and easy and powerful. And in fact, it doesn't quite mention that you need multiple Final Cut Pro licenses in order for that to work. So if you want to network 5 computers, you're going to be paying $1,400 times 5 in order for that to work. And Final Cut, unlike Leopard, does check for serial numbers over the network, and it will shut itself down if you are not using individual licenses to set up this render grid. So that's kind of another surprise that they give their users. Kind of you might call it an Easter egg, you know, because when you go to set up that grid like it's advertised, you find out at the very last stage that if you actually have these Final Cut Pro licenses running on different computers, all but one are going to shut down anyway, and the X-Grid is rendered useless. And what's really good is that Apple has the X-Grid, because free grid engines like the grid engine from Sun, or Dr. Q, the free grid engine, or any of these free open source render grids that they've created that will work fine with programs like Maya and Lightwave and Blender. None of them are able to support Final Cut Pro, because Final Cut Pro won't talk to those. So that's always nice, because, I mean, you don't need those. You have X-Grid, and all you have to do is pay $1,400 for as many times as you want to run Final Cut on your network, and you'll have the exact same thing. You don't exactly need to go out looking for a free solution when you can do that, right? Now, Final Cut Pro being $1,400, you would think there would just be nothing that you could throw at it that it can't roll with, right? Well, interestingly enough, iMovie 08 actually speaks to certain cameras more effectively than Final Cut Pro. And that's a wonderful little thing that Apple threw into the mix, because when you think about, you know, the price difference there, $1,400 versus $80, it's kind of a surprise that iMovie 08 would actually function better with certain cameras than Final Cut Pro. And you'd also imagine that since they're both running off of the same QuickTime engine, it wouldn't actually make a difference. But of course, it does. So what is it with QuickTime? Why is it so great? Is it the difference between QuickTime Free and QuickTime Pro for $30? Or is it something even deeper? For instance, codec support. Well, codecs are something that I love more than really anything else. And the more that we can have more and more codecs in the system, the better. There's nothing like trying to play a video and having to go out and find the codec for that operating system, for that specific kind of media. Now, what's really cool is that Apple just arbitrarily decides not to support certain codecs. And sometimes you can go out and find support for that codec outside of Apple, and sometimes you can't. It's, again, it's the mystery, it's the puzzle, it's the excitement, you know, it's the thrill of the hunt is what this is called. And this is what Apple is bringing to the table. And what about the whole OS X Just Works thing? Okay, so I admit that that's no longer an exclusive claim to Apple. Ubuntu can make the exact same claim, especially if you're loading it onto one of the Dell systems that they're selling with Ubuntu preloaded, or you're loading it onto a Centrino system with all Intel components. Ubuntu just works as well. But let's face it, OS X just works in the sense that the things that they want to work do, in fact, typically work, as long as you're not pushing it to the limit.